If you are just joining us, we are in the middle of a series of homilies that really began last year on Pope St. John Paul II's Theology of the Body. Last year, we reviewed part one, where the Pope Saint taught us Christ's three words about human love in Eden, on earth, and in eternity. Now we are following his teaching in part two about the great sacrament of marriage, the primordial expression of God's love that human persons as spouses are privileged to experience. More recently, we looked at how marriage is like Mount Everest in its reach and in its relevance to Catholic theology. And now we are considering the wedding work, that is, the bride's and groom's words and actions as they live this primordial sacrament. According to John Paul II, another way in which the spouse's body language teach the do's and don'ts of the social intercourse of heaven is by fulfilling the role of a prophet. That is, just as the prophets of the Old Testament, and John Paul highlights the ministry of Isaiah and Hosea and Ezekiel, taught Israel how they should relate to God, their bridegroom. So spousal love models how Christians should relate to Christ, our bridegroom. This is one sense of what the Pope means when he claims that human life is by its nature co-educational. Spouses educate each other as prophets educate others. And spouses together become a prophetic team to educate the world. But John Paul insists that the spouses' bodies fulfill this prophetic mission in a singular way. He says, on the basis of the prophetism, being a prophet, of the body, ministers of the sacrament of marriage perform an act of prophetic character. A prophet is one who expresses with human words the truth that comes from God, one who speaks this truth in the place of God, in his name, and in some sense with his authority. In other words, just as we must learn the different social mores and etiquette to successfully navigate cultures on earth, you remember, burping at the dinner table may be acceptable in Shanghai, but not in Shreveport. So the body language of spouses instruct us in the mores and etiquette of eternity, the do's and don'ts of heaven. Thus, the bodies of spouses serve as prophets who speak for God. The Holy Father adds another and perhaps the most crucial point about spousal body language, namely, this language can either be true or it can be false. It can be honest or it can lie. And the best way to measure the truth or falsity of body language is by using the gauge of the wedding vows. In this sense, we might say that spousal body language occurs on two valences or levels, like protons and neutrons spin at different valences around an atom. At one valence, spouses speak the truth by their bodies when they accurately reflect the words they spoke at their wedding. That is, when through their bodies they are loving and attentive and generous and forgiving and cheerful. At the other valence, however, the bodies of spouses can speak falsely, by contradicting the wedding vows, by being egotistical, petty, vain, deceptive, lazy, etc. John Paul puts it in its extreme terms. The body tells the truth through faithfulness and conjugal love. And when it commits adultery, it tells a lie. It commits falsehood. Let me give you some practical examples. I've noticed that some professional tennis players will, in effect, lie with their body language on the court. I once saw Carlos Alcaraz playing tennis against a less skilled player, and he turned his gaze toward one side of the court as if he were going to hit the ball over there, and his opponent moved in that direction. But Alcaraz actually hit the ball toward the other side of the court and easily won the point. The eyes of his body said one thing, but his shot did the opposite. Basketball players lie with their bodies by doing a no-look pass, deceiving the other team. Pitchers lie trying to catch the player leaning off of first base by a quick throw to get him out. Quarterbacks lie with a pump fake to cause the cornerback to come forward so that they can really throw a long pass. Lying with the body is helpful in sports, but it is harmful among spouses. Why would married couples ever engage in such deceptive body language? John Paul recalls here his earlier analyses about concupiscence to explain why the spouses' bodies might speak falsely or lie to one another. In previous miles, we discovered that concupiscence is the residual fallout from original sin, even after that sin has been forgiven by baptism. That is, concupiscence is a violent rupture in man's interior experience of original solitude, original unity, and original nakedness. Those three syllables of Christ's first word. Look at it this way. Whereas in Genesis chapter 2, before they committed original sin, Adam and Eve conversed through their body language truly and genuinely, honestly, indeed effortlessly, without any kind of lying with their body. Their body language, like the bodies themselves, were truly naked and without any pretense or posturing. Adam and Eve, in other words, would have been terrible NBA players, as Charles Barkley might say. Their bodies were not capable of throwing a no-look pass. However, beginning in Genesis 3, with the dawn of original sin, their bodies start to send false and deceptive signals. In fact, they learn to lie. The Pope describes how Adam and Eve's legacy of lying is a very apt analogy for concupiscence, and it continues to plague married couples today. He says, "We realize that the one who rereads this language and then expresses it not according to the needs proper to marriage as a covenant and sacrament is naturally and morally the man of concupiscence. Male and female, both man and woman, understood as the man of concupiscence." In other words, couples who are consumed by concupiscence fail to communicate through their bodies the simple truth of their wedding vows, but rather they speak falsely and contradict those vows. They are no longer holy prophets, their unholy prevaricators, like Judas, a false prophet who betrayed Jesus, the true prophet, with a kiss. Learning to read and speak the spousal body language, then, is the real wedding work of our third bucket of marriage preparation. When we arrive at our wedding day, we should focus not simply on the externals of whether the bride's train will be 2 feet or 12 feet long, or if you want 2 levels or 4 levels on the wedding cake. Rather, our attention should be absorbed by the internals of the depth of meaning of the wedding vows and catching the social, spiritual, and sexual cues that create a lifelong consortium vitae for heaven and earth. That is a true partnership of life, embracing every aspect. And that would not be such a terrible idea. Praised be Jesus Christ.